I'm Michael Geary, and this is the EU History Podcast. On this episode, we return to the 1970s, and we return to Britain and British EEC relations, but from a seldom examined perspective, namely the role of women within the debate on whether Britain should not only join the EEC, but whether it should remain inside the EEC when that decision was taken by the Labour government to hold that infamous 1975 referendum. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Richard Johnson, Senior Lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at Queen Mary, University of London, and the author of a really exciting recent article just published in the journal Contemporary British History entitled Women Against the Common Market. Richard, welcome to the EU History Podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
By way of kickstarting this, I have loads of questions for you because the article that you've just published is really, really innovative and touches upon one of these seldom examined areas. Perhaps might just start on what led you to your interest in your British Euroscepticism or Euroscepticism in Britain. And I think then by extension, how you discovered, which is a question I'm very fascinated about, this treasure trove of archival material on this Labour MP who kickstarts this particular movement, at least one association or one interest group against the common market.
Well, my job title is actually Senior Lecturer in US Politics. And so that was what most of my research was focused on. I'd always had a long-standing interest in British Labour Party history. My grandparents had been very active in the party in the post-war era, and my grandfather stood for Parliament for Labour a couple of times, met various Labour luminaries of the age like Attlee and Gateschill and Nye Bevan and so on. And during the 2016 referendum, I started to write some pieces about Labour's historical Euroscepticism, because I felt that there wasn't a lot of attention on that tradition. I came about Anne Kerr actually by reading a book called The Honourable Ladies, which is a collection of essays about every woman elected to the British Parliament from 1918 to 1996, edited by Ian Dale and Jackie Smith. And in that book, there is a chapter on Anne Kerr, written by the Green, now member of the House of Lords, Natalie Bennett, previously the leader of the Green Party. And as someone who has read and knows quite a lot about Labour history, I have to say I didn't know a great deal about Anne Kerr until I read that chapter. But she really jumped off the pages in that chapter. And I noticed that Natalie Bennett had looked at original archival collection of Anne Kerr at Hull. So that was what sparked my interest. I had been doing a project about Labour Euroscepticism more broadly, and I thought there might be some interesting stuff there. And truly, there was a treasure trove of great archival material at Hull about Anne Kerr and women against the common market.
And in terms of your family background, was there Euroscepticism there, or what were their views on Europe?
Well, as far as I can tell, my grandfather, I didn't actually get to meet him, but he left me his papers. My grandmother, once she passed away, she left me his papers and books. And my grandfather was on the kind of Bevanite left of the party, which was the Eurosceptic wing of the party. And certainly among his papers are papers that are critical of European economic and monetary integration. So my presumption is that, yes, he was probably also part of that Labour Eurosceptic tradition.
Yeah. As you say, Anne Kerr is central to this group, the Women Against the Common Market. You might just kind of contextualize who she was and her broader interest in the Europe question in the 60s and early 70s.
So Anne Kerr was a Labour MP for Rochester from 1964 to 1970. So she won her seat in the 64 election, was re-elected in 66, and then lost her seat in 1970. She was very much on the left of the party. She had, before entering politics, she'd been an actress. And I think that showed in the kind of style that she adopted as a politician. She was very theatrical. She had a real eye for publicity and stunts and getting the attention of the media. She was very active as an MP in the peace movement. She was so she would address big rallies in Trafalgar Square against nuclear weapons. She went to the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago to protest against the Vietnam War and was beaten up and arrested by the police. And when she was hauled before the notorious Judge Julius Hoffman, she burst out singing "We Shall Overcome," which then added to her notoriety in the United States. She's also very strongly against apartheid, organized a boycott of the South African rugby team. And so she was very much associated with kind of internationalist left-wing causes. And at that time in the Labour Party, skepticism to the EC, or the common market, as is often called in those circles, was sort of part of that package. And when she lost her seat in 1970, she initially started to look around for seats to stand for Parliament again, but then quite quickly got involved in the kind of broader Eurosceptic movement and was encouraged actually by the leader of the Keep Britain Out campaign, Christopher Freer-Smith, to set up her own Eurosceptic organization focused specifically on women.
This led her then to set up this particular interest group solely on women. But when I read your work, I was struck because she, as you say, she is so into all of these big issues of the day, nuclear disarmament, apartheid. But I'm struck, I suppose, by the composition of the group. It doesn't reach such a wide audience, because even at the time, at the end of the 1960s, the anti-apartheid movement in Britain is quite a large group that moves, that expands largely through labor and trade union networks in many constituencies in Britain, because the Irish anti-apartheid movement models itself on that. And I was struck then when I read your article about women against the common market. It's, I suppose, the composition and the outreach are not as wide as I thought they would be. Why is this?
I think you have to think about the ecosystem of Eurosceptic organizations in Britain at the time. Mm. So Christopher Freer-Smith led the Keep Britain Out group. That was mostly kind of liberal free traders. He'd been a liberal. You had the Anti-Common Market League, which was a pretty kind of right-wing nationalist conservative group. You had the Common Market Safeguards campaign, which was mostly led by labor and trade unionist figures. And you had the World Development Movement, which was not specifically focused on Europe, but had a kind of within it campaigners who were focused on opposing the EC from an international development standpoint. And I guess what happened was Freer-Smith said to Kerr, look, we've got a gap in the market here when it comes to targeting women. And there was a sense after the 1970 election that women had given Ted Heath that larger than expected majority. And women were found to be fairly Eurosceptic, and there was a sense in polling, women were showing up to be more Eurosceptic than men. And so he kind of encouraged her to put herself in that lane. But I actually think that was somewhat of a uncomfortable position for Kerr. I think she, you know, she wasn't kind of a feminist campaigner in that respect. I mentioned in the article, for example, she actually voted against the legalization of abortion or the Abortion Reform Act in 1967. She had a small C conservatism to her on certain matters as well. And so I think that maybe it wasn't actually her natural kind of grouping. I think she probably would have been more comfortable as the head of a kind of international development, anti-racism type Eurosceptic campaign group, but that's not where the movement felt she was needed. And so that's, I think, explains part of her positioning there. Mm.
And as we move towards 1972 and negotiations and the vote in Parliament, I mean, what are the group campaigning on? What are the women against the common market? What are the issues that they find so objectionable when it comes to EEC membership?
Well, the group is founded at the end of 1970, and its main mission is to stop the passage of the European Communities Act. And that is what Kerr devotes the next 2 years of her life, in effect, to trying to achieve. And she does this in a variety of ways. One is that the group tries to meet with senior politicians and to, in effect, directly lobby MPs. And Kerr, because of her previous experience in Parliament, is somewhat successful in that. The group gets private audiences with Harold Wilson, Michael Foote, Geoffrey Rippon on the Conservative side, who negotiated Britain's entry, with Jeremy Thorpe, the Labour leader, and a variety of other politicians. It's not clear that the group's meetings ever really change the views of the politicians they meet with, but they do get to be able to have those discussions. But the other thing that Kerr does is she's very clever at getting media attention for various stunts. So although the group is quite small and it doesn't have a mass membership at all, it's basically just run out of this kind of central committee which Kerr leads. They do get on the front page of The Guardian and The Observer and lots of national and regional papers. They do various things. They protest outside of Chequers when Georges Pompidou comes to visit Ted Heath. They stage rallies in Trafalgar Square. They hold protests. They manage to get some left-wing groups to fund the printing of loads of shopping bags, which become the kind of trademark item of no to common market branded shopping bags. They had other ideas which they didn't act on, probably quite rightly. One was that they were going to hire a stripper and get the stripper to be dressed in items of clothing that said things like British Liberty, New Zealand Lamb, West Indian Sugar, and to strip these off to signify what would be lost joining. That was probably quite rightly dropped as an idea. But this gives to show you the kind of the flavor of some of the ideas. Of course, they're probably their most infamous stunt was that they went to France in 1972, the French had a referendum on whether to admit Britain and Ireland and Denmark and so on, or to veto the expansion of the EC. And Women Against the Common Market and various trade unionists teamed up together, went to France to try to encourage the French to vote to block Britain's entry again. But they were they violated French law, which said you couldn't campaign so close to the referendum date, and they were deported as a result.
And it's you've mentioned, I mean, she's at the center of many of these big developments. I mean, the Heath Pompidou meeting is famous in terms of getting in pushing forward the British negotiations because they were being bogged down, and it took this important meeting between the British Prime Minister and the French President to kind of move the dial. But did she and did Women Against the Common Market as a group, did they feel that the stunts were the Westminster-based London stunts were enough to attract publicity that might, you know, move the message around the country? Because they certainly, from your reading your article, they didn't do that much traveling to the north of England or into Scotland or anywhere else. Did they feel that these kinds of stunts were enough to capture the public imagination, and then that message would resonate or would travel without them needing to expand the group's reach into, you know, to women's organizations elsewhere in the country?
Well, the minutes of the meetings, which were a great find in the archives, do show that there's constant discussion about kind of broadening their reach and going beyond London. And Kerr and some of the other members of the group, which they would call WACM, or one commentator called them WACO, but WACM, Women Against the Common Market, they did go to Manchester, I think Newcastle. They did get some invitations to speak elsewhere. I know that they got an invitation to speak in like Cumbria, for example. But in some of these instances, because the group itself was so London and home counties centric, they didn't have surrogates who were women to go out. In some cases, they had to ask male MPs who were friends of Anne Kerr, who represented constituencies elsewhere, to speak on behalf of Women Against the Common Market, which is a rather bizarre situation to be in. I think part of the problem was that Kerr was so personally invested in this organization, she was not very willing to delegate or to expand out. So there's this constant back and forth in the minutes about them, you know, hiring somewhat like a secretary to help with the admin of the group. And Kerr just won't have it. She's sort of, she takes it as like an insult. Why do you not think I'm, you know, good enough managing the group myself? And you can see letters to Kerr from members, sort of they're flattering her, saying, you know, you've put so much time and effort and energy in this. We wouldn't be where we are without you. But don't you think you could do with a bit of help? And so there is, I think there's a problem of kind of personality there and not wanting to let go. And of course, this becomes a problem when Kerr suddenly and tragically dies in 1973, because there isn't that infrastructure to run the organization with, really without her. Once she goes, the organization does carry on in name for a few more years, but basically without her, it's nothing. Mm.
I was struck when I read your article about the shopping bags, and one of the questions I had meant to ask you was, did you find any in the archive of what these actually looked like? Is there any visual evidence left? I was quite curious about this, but it was a very clever way of connecting two women, because there was that kind of narrative between shopping bags, grocery shopping, and the costs of food. That she argued, which was one of the issues they campaigned on, was that joining the EEC would mean the cost of living would go up.
I found lots of pictures of them, and there were pictures that got into the newspapers as well with women carrying them, and the thousands of them were produced, but I didn't find an extant one. I don't know if any exists anywhere.
I'm sure they were just plastic, right? I mean, it was just...
Yeah, I think that's right. Bags. If anyone happens to have one, please
let me know. Yes, I would be fascinated too whether any have survived.
But it's, you know, what was very interesting about doing this piece, particularly from looking at a women's campaign group at this time, was that women's status as a consumer gave them a kind of political right to speak beyond kind of the immediate family issues, right? So by being, you know, okay, you know, it's still very gendered, shopping and so on, but it enabled the group to talk about international trade, and also to talk about international development. And so Kerr, once she starts talking about, you know, the different prices of the shop, she's also talking about how, you know, the developing world, the Commonwealth in particular, relies on being able to export to Britain, and we're going to be damaging them. And Kerr was very passionate about the Commonwealth, so that gave her an opportunity to talk about the Commonwealth. So the shopping bags, that was one set of issues, I think, was trade and kind of international relations and Britain and the world that allowed. And the other issue that Wackham was very passionate about was kind of democracy itself, and this perception of Europe as not being very democratic. And I think that was also somewhat gendered, but again, in an interesting way, where, you know, these were women of a generation who were, you know, had parents or grandparents who won the right to vote, you know, mothers or grandmothers. And for them, that kind of sense of like, this is like British democracy is actually quite fresh and new. Women didn't get the equal right to vote until, you know, 1929. It's not that far in people's frame of reference. And so that's the other kind of set of issues that they were very motivated about.
And women appear from your research to be more Eurosceptical than men, or more Eurosceptical than men prior to accession. But then post-72 or post-73 tend to move into the more pro-EEC camp. How do we explain this?
Yeah, it's one that I've kind of gone over in my mind. I mean, one potential theory is that women were a more conservative electorate at that time. Obviously, these days we think of, particularly in Britain at least, we think of women as a more kind of more to the left than the median male voter. But in that, that's only a phenomenon in Britain, at least, of the kind of post, since New Labour, basically, since 1997. Mm. So before then, women tended to be more conservative than men. And that may not just be politically conservative, but also in the sense of party politics, but also in kind of certain outlooks. And so one theory is that, you know, joining the EEC was like quite a big change. And women were, I mean, one of the things, for example, one of the campaigns that Anne Kerr was also passionate about was she was against decimalizing the British currency. She liked keeping the old money. And she argued that this was because women knew how to use the old money, and that decimalization was an elite, bureaucratic, male-dominated enterprise. And so this was actually taking power away from women. And I guess the theory might be that once Britain was in the EEC, leaving was the more disruptive thing than staying in. And so perhaps, you know, a kind of small C conservative electorate just made its peace with Europe. And also, I think there was a sense that the kind of the dramatic food increases the dramatic increase in the price of food didn't really materialize in the way that some had warned. I mean, Anne Kerr campaigns in the early 70s saying that food will become so expensive that the British will be forced to eat horse meat. And this is something that, you know, she says already they're doing on the continent because the prices are so high because they've got these protectionist tariffs, and the British Sunday roasts will be a thing of the past, and the best we'll be able to do is have a bit of horse gristle. So because that didn't happen, I think that also put laid to rest some of those concerns.
I mean, it is fascinating reading your work, because when you look at the Irish case in parallel at the exact same time, there is none of this. There's none of these, you know, far or, you know, hard left debates. Even from a gendered perspective, most Irish people simply see this as a win-win for them. And so it's really interesting reading about these groups, not least the women's groups, who have got really, I think, intelligent arguments. I mean, some are on the more extreme, like the horse meat and things and the end of the British Sunday roast. I mean, but some of the arguments are quite well informed. But as you mentioned earlier, Anne Kerr tragically dies before the Labour Party decide to put all of this to a renegotiation and then ultimately to a referendum. How active or how impactful is the group Women Against the Common Market when we get to 1974-75? Or is it simply Anne Kerr is gone and simply the group then has lost momentum?
Yeah, so I mean, Anne Kerr was... sadly, she was an alcoholic, and she suffered with that all throughout her political career. The last activity that I can find of WACM was actually when the European Communities Act went for royal consent in the autumn of 1972, and Kerr writes to the Queen personally and begs her to exercise her prerogative of veto to stop. Obviously, the Queen didn't do that. And then it sounds like she went into a deep depression, and 6-7 months after Britain becomes a member of the EC, she's found dead at the side of her bed by her husband, Russ Kerr, who was also a left-wing Labour MP, and she died of alcohol poisoning. She was only 48. The organisation does carry on in name, but I find almost no mention of it at all in the 75 referendum. In the papers of the National Referendum Campaign, the No Campaign, in Parliament, there is a letter from Women Against the Common Market to the Oxford researcher, UA Kitzinger, who was writing with David Butler, quite well-known book now, on the 1975 referendum. And Kitzinger writes to one of the members, Barbara Fellows, and says, you know, you weren't very active in the campaign. You know, why not? We're curious, but we wanted to write about you in our book, but we can't find any mention of your activities in the newspaper cuttings. And she writes back this really acerbic, kind of vicious reply about how dare he write in this way to the organization, and the quality of the book he's writing with David Butler will probably be on the, you know, akin to to Beano or the Common Cuts, you know, a Comic Cuts. I mean, it's just such it's a really strange reply. So there were some women who had been involved, who'd been friends of Kerr, who kind of, you know, they had the letterhead still in 75, but I don't really know if they did anything. And if they did, it didn't get any media attention, which just, I think, goes to show how vital Kerr was, both organizationally, but also using her links as a politician, a former politician, and her kind of eye for the media to actually get that quite small group to have an outsized influence in public debate.
But this article is not the end of your interest in Euroscepticism. Now you are now writing a or working on a book on Labour and Euroscepticism. When can we discuss this on my podcast?
Well, unfortunately, I've got a long pipeline of different research projects. I mean, this book is, in a sense, it's been a long-standing kind of background project that I've been working on, where it's been very fruitful in spinning out lots of different articles and things like this along the way. So, you know, I've written different chapters and books about Neil Kinnock and John Smith's views on Europe, on the Labour MEPs who started out as the most Eurosceptic group in the European Parliament when they came in. I'm currently writing a chapter on Judith Hart, who was Overseas Development Minister at the time of the 75 referendum, was also a left-wing Eurosceptic, had very similar views to Ann Kerr, and also sadly was also struggled with alcohol addiction as well. So there's lots of interesting overlaps between the two of them. But the book is a kind of a bit of a mammoth project, and I don't have a deadline date on that. But hopefully, in the process of doing the research for it, it means that along the way, I'll be publishing more stuff about Labour Eurosceptics through history, which might be of interest to your listeners.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking of so many ideas in terms of how Labour Eurosceptics adapted to life inside the EEC, because they were also in power from 74. So there is that element of, you know, did they just become resigned to this reality of being inside, and then they accepted the reality of being a member, or how far they were able to reconcile their Eurosceptic views while in power during the rest of the 1970s. So I think there's so many really interesting avenues of research, and that's just from that particular decade. So,
well, there's so many, just on that, I mean, there's so many interesting parallels with after the 2016 referendum, because there's a big debate in the Labour Eurosceptic movement as to whether or not they should respect the referendum result, or if the referendum result was advisory, you know, were the public misinformed in 75, you hear Eurosceptics say, you know, basically, you know, they were lied to. I mean, it's just sort of, it's so funny. It's kind of the reverse of what happened after 2016.
To segue away from your research and to conclude this episode of the EU History Podcast, each guest is asked a random question from the Proust questionnaire. Richard, here is yours. What is your most treasured possession?
Well, I'd actually already mentioned it, which is the collection of papers and books that belonged to my grandfather. I never got to meet him. He sadly died of a heart attack relatively young, but he was someone who came from real abject poverty in Newcastle. He was an orphan and then became a teacher, was very involved in the Socialist Education Association, stood for Parliament for Labour a couple of times, was a Labour councillor, very active in the comprehensive education movement, and left when he died to my grandmother. And then when my grandmother died, who I knew very well, she left to me all these fantastic books from the Left Book Club from the 1930s and 40s, and books by Nye Bevan, a book that belonged to Barbara Castle with her name in it, books on the trade union movement, and some of his writings as well. And, you know, if there was a fire in my house and I could only take one thing out of it, that would be the thing, bag of stuff I try and get out of the house.
First, nice. Dr. Richard Johnson, Senior Lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at Queen Mary, University of London. Thanks for being my guest on this episode of the EU History Podcast. I'm Michael Geary. Thanks for listening.
Thanks very much.